It's not like there's a huge amount on today, so the luck will be out here by 4:30, but we'll do our best anyway. As you may have seen today, I announced that I'll be travelling to Laos next week for the East Asian Summit before heading to the Federated States of Micronesia for the Pacific Islands Forum. At the East Asian Summit, the focus will be on important regional issues including counter-terrorism, fisheries management and the South China Seas. New Zealand has strong interests in all of these areas as they have a direct impact on our peace and prosperity. At the summit, I will meet with a number of leaders to progress other issues of importance to New Zealand. This will include Prime Minister Thong Luong of Laos, who I wish to meet with to discuss how we can grow the relationship between our two countries. New Zealand and Laos already share a strong relationship working together on important development issues like the removal of unexploded ordnance and growing the tourism sector there. I look forward to building on that further. After Laos, I'll be travelling to Ponape in the Federated States of Micronesia. I'm looking forward to taking part in the Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting there from the 9th to 11th of September. The forum is a great opportunity to meet with leaders of 15 other Pacific countries to consider the issues in our region that we can best tackle by working together. High on our agenda this year are climate change and sustainable fisheries management, and I know that other leaders will want to focus on other areas as well. We all share the goal of encouraging an ambitious and effective global response to climate change. We've announced our own intention to ratify the Paris Agreement limiting global warming this year, and we welcome the leadership shown by many Pacific Island countries in this area. We're also providing assistance to the region to help mitigate the risks posed by climate change, as well for disaster risk management, renewable energy, and helping Pacific countries to access climate finance. In fisheries, we're helping Pacific countries get better value from their tuna resource and use it sustainably. And we have a particular focus on combating illegal and unregulated fishing. At the forum, we'll also discuss PACER Plus trade agreement, which aims to create jobs, raise the standard of living, and encourage sustainable economic development in the Pacific. The agreement is important to the economic prosperity and sustainability of a region that faces a number of challenges trading internationally. At a meeting in Christchurch last week, ministers agreed to conclude negotiations by the end of October and to sign the agreement by the end of the year. Australia and New Zealand also announced funding of $4 million each to help Pacific countries benefit from the agreement. Finally, in terms of my activities for the week, I'm in Wellington tomorrow, Christchurch on Wednesday, Gisborne on Thursday, and Auckland on Friday.
Mr. Keith, what have you written to the Chinese community on the issue of crime in Auckland in particular, and a feeling amongst the Asian community there that they are being targeted? Why did you take that step?
Look, I think there are some in the Chinese community who do feel that they're being targeted. I don't think they are, but it's certainly one thing I wanted to do was reassure them. I write a weekly column for the newspapers, and that goes to a range of ethnic media. One of the newspapers came back and asked us if we could just do that this week in the form of an open letter, and so we just turned the column, if you like, into that open letter. So it's really sort of standard. It hasn't been solely specific for the Chinese community, but it was an attempt to reassure them that we take the issue seriously.
Are you worried that, because we've seen an online survey recently this week showing 60% feel unsafe, that there is a risk to New Zealand's international reputation that these stories are being picked up in China?
Well, it's just we have a lot of contact, I think, with the Chinese community and other ethnic communities. I think we know them pretty well. And it has been an issue that's been raised a little bit with me recently and with other ministers. So we just wanted to make sure that they were aware of what the government's doing. I mean, obviously, we didn't influence it, but we're happy with the decision that the police have made, saying they'll now be attending every burglary. They used to attend the majority, but again, I think some will take real confidence in that. So it's just one of those issues that we address. We do it on a weekly basis. Just happened to be this time.
It's a case of desperation because you haven't funded the police enough, and that's why crime's got away.
Well, that's just not true. I mean, firstly, the national crime rate's down. Secondly, if you go and have a look at the additional funding, there's well over 600 extra police, I think 686 from memory. Plus, we've been funding significant amount more for technology. So they've got a lot of technological advances in recent years. So I don't think that's really right. I mean, you have certain areas where the crime has gone up, partly sometimes because it's reported a lot more. We're seeing that in the area, for instance, of sexual violence and domestic violence, for instance, but overall rates have generally been coming down.
How often have you sent out a letter like this on prime ministerial letterhead to clearly to the Chinese community, it says here? That seems fairly unusual move.
Don't know. I mean, as I said, it's just my regular column. They asked me to put it in that way, so I often see any issues with that. But we write to lots of people.
Is it just to the Chinese community, or is this letter gone?
Oh, the column, it's effectively a letter. It was a column that was turned into a letter, and the column was broadly spread.
So to like the Indian community?
Yeah.
Do you think there is concern amongst the ethnic community, not just Chinese, but say for instance the Indian community as well, about crime?
It's always an issue. And I think there's a lot of small business owners and a lot of retail owners, or people that work in, you know, areas that face the community, taxi drivers and the likes, and so they do see a degree of crime, and it's always an issue that we're concerned about. If you go and talk to ethnic communities, by and large, that's one issue that generally gets raised.
Do you think the attitude to housing and the mix of housing and migration is adding to that attitude?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it's just one of those issues that it depends on, you know, sometimes there's a few high-profile burglaries or, you know, assaults, and they sort of tend to raise those issues in the community. I just think that sometimes those communities feel a little bit vulnerable to those sort of high-profile attacks that we see. It's not new. I remember it over a long period of time where it comes and goes a little bit. So it's partly just made back to them in reassurance. There's been a little bit of discussion in some of the community about people sort of taking the law into their own hands, you know, basically arming themselves a bit more. And I think we're certainly trying to give them reassurance that that's not a good thing to do, that really they should leave that in the hands of the police.
Are you trying to calm them down? Are you worried that things might escalate a bit?
I just wouldn't want to see that happen because it could put them more at risk.
Sorry, just to clarify, you're saying is you've heard reports that there are people in the Chinese community who would take up arms.
Well, just people generally that are saying, well, you know, maybe they need to take greater steps to protect themselves. And again, it's not new, but you sometimes hear those things, and we just want to make sure that people are well and truly aware that the police take their responsibilities seriously, that they're well resourced, and they're the people for protecting.
But these concerns are coming to you from the Chinese community in this case?
I'd say broadly across a range of communities.
So is it out of ethnic communities that they're talking about taking up arms?
Basically? Well, protecting themselves more, maybe.
In what sort of way? Like guns and baseball bats? What are you hearing?
Yeah, more probably the latter than the former. But yeah, again, you sometimes see, I mean, I've seen you guys report it, you know, where people say, you know, thinking about keeping those kinds of things.
So why do ethnic communities get this letter and not... Why has it gone to ethnic communities rather than...
Oh, just because I have a weekly column in their newspapers, so if the New Zealand Herald or News Hub wants to have it on their site, please let my office know, and we'll absolutely love to put it in there.
Pretty,
yeah.
So you don't believe this clearly says to dear Chinese friends in New Zealand, this is clearly targeted at the Chinese community. Do other communities not get the same open letter?
Well, as I understand it, the column was widespread amongst all of the Chinese, all of the media outlets that will take a column from me, and that's across a wide range of ethnic community media. But this particular media outlet asked me if I would redo it in the form of an open letter.
But so that's important, isn't it? Because the people I've spoken to about this, taking it as you writing them a letter, taking the personal effort to write that letter.
Yeah, well, we do. We take the issue seriously. As I said, if any newspaper in New Zealand wants to give us column space, we're more than happy to take acceptance from the Dominion Post or the New Zealand Herald or others. If you'll give us room, we'll write one tomorrow.
Can I ask you about the next Security Council ballot?
Yeah.
Do you have something in your mind, a threshold below which Clark would need to pull out? And also, do you think that the contest is starting to affect New Zealand's agenda on the Security Council in any way?
I definitely don't think it's having any impact on our agenda or the issues we're trying to push on the Security Council. We're not holding back our punches because we're trying to support Helen Clark's candidature. In terms of September, obviously, it's an important month for us because we're presidents of the Security Council, and so that'll give us an opportunity to push an agenda which will be in relation to Syria, is likely to be the area we're obviously trying to make progress. In terms of the former, I don't have a particular threshold where I think it would be a good idea either to stay in the race or get out of the race. I think that's a matter for Helen. She can assess that best, but obviously we hope that she starts moving up a little bit and not moving down, but she's doing her best. She's giving it a good shot, and but luck she'll get some movement positively.
What's your definition of making progress with Syria? What would be your takeaway?
Well, it's a place where 13 million people approximately are homeless.
No, better than the Security Council.
Oh, the Security Council. Well, I think some form of... I mean, if we could get some form of resolution, that would continue to lend support to the people of Syria and look to resolve some of the issues that they have there, then that would be useful. But I think it's one of those things where it's a difficult and delicate process, and I think we have to be realistic. There's a number of interested parties, obviously, there, and there's a broad number of countries very actively involved. So we're just trying to progress along that issue.
Prime Minister, is it Russia that has filed to discourage votes in the electoral problems?
Well, we don't exactly know because it's a secret ballot, so people are always sort of guessing. But there's no secret that Russia believes it's the turn of an Eastern European candidate. So they have been actively promoting that. And if not an Eastern European, then they've been promoting a European. So we don't know exactly who votes for who.
And you've called all the other leaders of the P5.
Yep.
Will you call for the leader of Putin? Will you actually
think so. The foreign ministers had quite extensive conversations with the Russian foreign minister, Lavrov. I mean, I think if we thought it would move things along, we would. But they're quite clear in their view that they believe it should be an Eastern European, and I don't think it would achieve a lot.
So you don't have that kind of relationship with Russia that you do with the other
countries? Probably not as close, but anyway, they've been quite adamant in their view. And they're not in any way, shape or form being duplicitous. They're not saying one thing to our face and nothing behind our back. They're quite clear and open with us that they believe it should be an Eastern European candidate. In the event that there isn't one, or a European, then it's a very different story, but they've been quite honest and open and upfront with us about what they think is the right, or where the right candidate comes from.
Have you ever had a one-on-one conversation with Vladimir Putin about anything, ever?
Yep.
What was that about?
I met him at numerous things, both East Asian summits and APEC, when he's been both Prime Minister and President, had a number of conversations with him. And obviously I went to Vladivostok when they hosted APEC.
Who's representing the United States and Russia at the East Asian summit then?
I imagine it's Obama at the East Asian summit, but I might be wrong. I didn't hear anything to the counter.
Would you take the opportunity to talk to either of either Obama or the Russian PM or President?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've had a discussion with President Obama already, and I'd probably look to follow up that conversation. If it's Medvedev at the East Asian Summit, as Prime Minister, then I'll certainly raise the issue with him. It's not like we're shying away from it. I'm just saying that to be fair to the Russians, they're just being very straightforward. They just believe it should be an Eastern European, and they're saying that.
What about the US? What they're saying?
I'm not going to go into all the conversations I had with the President, because I don't think that's appropriate. But it's, I think he has a lot of respect for Helen Clark. But, ultimately we'll see how it goes.
Do you think it would help the New Zealand efforts in the UN as President of the Security Council if Helen Clark did back out and support another candidate? Would it help with some of those relationships?
Would it help our relationships if she backed out?
Oh, New Zealand's, I guess, agenda on the security.
I don't think it has any impact. We see them as quite separate issues. We are well and truly confident about our capacity both to push an agenda along in the Security Council, like what's happening in Syria, and generally speaking, prior to this, the Middle East peace process and a number of other issues we've discussed, as well at exactly the same time, making the case that John Clark would be a very good UN secretary.
Does that reform agenda hinder her chances, given there has been some resistance among members of the P5 for reforms to the UN Security Council?
No, I mean, one of the points I've been making to the P5 members is that I think that reform is coming to the United Nations. I don't know under what time scale. I suspect a much longer one than what New Zealand would want, because we're one of the group of countries that's been looking to advance reform. We know that at least two of the P5 members support our views. And I do think that ultimately the Security Council, particularly the Permanent Five, do have to start asking the question about whether they can allow a continuation of the fact that the veto can be used when, you know, potentially, you know, mass atrocities take place in the country. I personally think that's an outrageous situation. And I do think there should be an exception in the veto when it comes to that kind of scenario.
Plastic bag taxes work quite well in the UK. Why are you not minded to introduce one here?
I think the general view has been a preference to try and get a voluntary sort of change. I mean, some retail outlets do either have a small surcharge or do use paper bags and the likes. And we think it sort of sits in the camp at the moment of consumer awareness rather than another tax.
But New Zealand's demonstrated its commitment to the marine environment with carbon expansion, yep. So wouldn't this just be another great way of doing that?
Look, I haven't seen any advice recently, but some time ago I remember getting a note on it, and the general advice was that it was better for us to continue to advance it through the way of active encouragement than a tax, but I haven't seen anything to contradict that.
But that hasn't really been working, has it?
I honestly don't have those stats to hand. I'd need to have a look.
Prime Minister, how many times have you met King Tuakea? Say this year?
Well, he hasn't turned up to quite a number of functions I've been at where he's been listed as an attendee, because I don't think his health's been in fantastic shape. I can't honestly tell you this year. You'd have to ask my office, they'd let you know. But I mean,
I've
only had one-on-one meetings with him like I can recall this year, but I have in the past, I think.
Sure. In my opening statements, you made reference to the agenda at the Pacific Islands Forum. Yeah. Fisheries, sustainability, and climate change. That seems to come up pretty much every year as far as the PIF is concerned. So does it mean the resolutions that were made last year and the year before haven't been enacted or aren't being followed properly?
No, not at all. If you look at something like fisheries, we organised a meeting because we were interested in advancing the way that they both manage sustainably their fisheries and maximise the value that they get for their resource. We organised a meeting of Pacific Island fisheries ministers in New Zealand. I understand that took place and it was very successful. As you know, we hosted some years ago now the Renewable Energy Summit here in Auckland. That got, I think, under $700 million worth of pledges and commitments, and we've been rolling out renewable energy projects across the Pacific. I mean, I think logically one of the reasons why those issues come up time and again is because the forum is really about, in the first instance, trying to lift the economic prosperity of the islands of the Pacific. And one of the ways to do that is obviously create an economic base where people have got jobs to go to. And the easiest place to create jobs is in the areas where they have a competitive advantage. So we're always trying to sort of, you know, help them in those areas. Ultimately, whether it's fisheries or tourism or some of the other, you know, aspects of developing their economy, RSC has been an important part of that, as you've had remittances coming back to the Pacific. So it's sort of normal that they would be on the agenda. But it's equally true when we go to APEC, it's all economic. When we go to the East Asian Summit, it's largely regional security issues. It's not unique.
Do you see democracy issues around what's been happening in PNG thing on the agenda or discussed?
I don't think specifically it will be in relation to PNG. I mean, we've been strong advocates of democracy, which is why we took the stance, especially under Helen Clark and then under my government, in relation to Fiji. It's been a consistent stance that we've taken over the military coups over the years. We do put a high value in democracy and people's right to elect their officials. And we can see some fragility in some of those countries, and It's why we take the sort of stance that we do.
Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull returns to work tomorrow after his election with a slimmer majority. As someone who has worked well in a minority government, do you have any friendly advice to your good friend about how he should proceed in the new parliament?
Not advice I think we're going to give him through the media. We'll just wish him the best. I mean, you know, he's won an election and I'm sure he'll be advancing the causes of the campaign.
Prime Minister, what did you make of the standing down of Matt McCartan as the Labour chief of staff that's been through on Tavish?
Is that definitely happening? I mean, I saw reports of
it. He's moving to Auckland into a different role.
Yeah, look, I don't know Matt terribly well. I mean, you know, I'm sure they have his own reasons for doing that, but it's not of any great real consequence to the government.
Does it mean for the stability of the parliamentary Labour Party to have gone through five chief of staffs in however many years you've been in power?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they've had a lot of staff changes around there. I don't think they've even got a chief press secretary at the moment, but, you know, it's a matter for them to really deal with.
And in Auckland at the moment, there's a French naval frigate parked near the place where the Rainbow Warrior was blown up. What do you think of that sort of symbolism?
Well, I don't think it would be deliberately parked there. It's probably the place it was allocated. But, we had the French Prime Minister here, Prime Minister Valls, as you know, the first French Prime Minister to come in 25 years here very recently. He made all the right points, I thought, on the Rainbow Warrior to say that, you know, I offered an apology for what had taken place. You know, our two countries have moved on from that point, and I think we accept that apology in good faith and take the relationship further.
How important is it for you to have a High Commissioner with trade experience in that role when the role comes up again?
Look, at the margins, it might, you know, be one of those things that helps, but in the end, you know, we've just got to have a good representative for New Zealand. I mean, it's a very big post from our perspective, and, you know, generally speaking, it's, you know, in the modern world, sort of Canberra, Washington, you know, I'll say, you know, London and Beijing, not necessarily in that order, but they're probably the big four, I suppose. And so there's a lot of Kiwis over there and a lot of interests that we have. So it is a changing dynamic in the relationship that we're having to negotiate, but the main thing that will help us is the goodwill on both sides and someone that can represent us to facilitate that, and I'm pretty confident we'll get that.
So are you rethinking that appointment? If you had someone in mind, are you rethinking that?
No, not as far as I'm aware.
Prime Minister, in terms of the South China Sea, when you go into the East Asia Summit, what does New Zealand stand in the territorial dispute then?
Well, we'll just continue to reaffirm our position, which is we don't take sides. We do want to see, you know, a peaceful resolution. It is a very important way from New Zealand's perspective. And, you know, peace and stability in the region are very important. So, you know, obviously we've had now the ruling out of the Hague. And I guess we'll be looking to see, you know, what discussions and what advancement that the Philippines and China have as a result of that. And I'm sure that's an issue that they're at least working their way through or having some discussions about.
Just back to Sec Jen quickly.
Yeah.
Is it possible that a standoff between the US and Russia could work in Helen's favour?
Well, I think so. One body of thought has always been that Helen Clark could potentially be the compromise candidate, that if, you know, the Russians were to be supporting one candidate, they would be vetoed by one of the other P5 members and vice versa, that ultimately she could be seen as a very safe pair of hands coming through the middle. And I still think that's legitimate. So while the straw polls haven't been that strong for her initially, I don't think that means that she's completely out of the race. It makes it a little more challenging. And everyone can see the tactical voting that's going on here. So I suspect, you know, bluntly, it's either going to improve for her later in the week, or, you know, life's going to get a little bit tougher, but with a bit of luck, it's going to improve. But, you know, she can only do what she's doing, which is campaigning strongly. She's got a good team. We're doing everything we can to help her. But she's also up against some difficult forces, and so much that people have a strong view and are protecting their own interests. And while we understand that, we don't support that view.
Do you have any intel on who the single opponent of the Portuguese candidate is? Do you have any idea who that is?
Oh, look, I haven't spent much time speculating on
the votes. He's on the top.
Yeah, Guterres, yeah. Well, he was 14, you know, or something in the first round, or whatever it was, and won neutral or something like that. I mean, look, I don't have a strong view. What I what I'm focused on is you know, Helen's results. And everyone can speculate about who's encouraging, who's discouraging, and who's neutral. Like a lot of these votes, even if you think you know, you don't always know the answer to those. In a sense, it's not so much important the individual countries now, it's important about the direction.
Who's your second preference?
Helen Pope would get it? We haven't had a really extensive discussion about that. If she wasn't in the race, who we would vote for. I mean, we obviously know how we voted in the first round and the first two rounds. But we have to wait and see. I mean, at the moment, the focus has been solely on getting her there, and we don't tend to spend any time thinking about that unless we're forced to think about it.
Who do we discourage?
We just don't talk about who we vote for either. You know, it's not in New Zealand's interest to dispose our voting papers for obvious reasons.